Well, I must say, when we talked about our lineup of authors down here at the Pioneer Women's Memorial Gardens that we were speaking to, the one that generated the most excitement was my next guest. And that has to do, I'm sure, with the multitudes of people who have read his various series of books and other writing. Can I see a show of hands? How many here have read at least one of Alexander McCall Smith's books? Yes, and I suspect that's why everyone is here. And it's nice to welcome him to the 891 stage, Alexander McCall Smith. Good afternoon.
Hello, Sonia.
Lovely to have you along.
Thank you very much.
Now, I'm not sure what the latest count is, but it's certainly multi-millions. I thought 20 million copies you've sold around the world.
Probably.
Does that get boring after a while?
Well, no. I don't know the number, but it's over that. I don't keep very good track.
Be impolite, wouldn't it? I love that here at Adelaide Writers Week we've been able to go to various parts of the world, and for many people you have taken them probably for the first and the only time to Botswana.
Right, yes. Well, I've been very happy that my books have been able to introduce people to Botswana, because I think it's a wonderful country, and I think that probably comes out in the way in which I describe it. I like it very much indeed, and I'm delighted if people feel inspired to visit Botswana after they've read one of the Mara Matswi books. And a lot of people do, actually. They go off to Botswana. Then they come back and they say, "We met Mara Matswi, we met this woman, and it was exactly like Mara Matswi. Was that her?" So that's very positive as far as I'm concerned.
Who was she for you?
Who was she for me?
Did she come from a character, or a person you'd met?
She didn't come from a particular person. I think that many people feel that writers base all their characters, or many of their characters, on actual people. And I think that's probably not the case. Occasionally people do that. I think you have to be very careful if you base a literary character on a real person, because I don't think you could write anything which was unkind or cruel, because the person couldn't really reply. So it's safer to have totally fictional characters. Mara Matswi isn't based on any actual person. There was one person who inspired me to write about a woman in Botswana. I saw this woman chasing a chicken, as it happened, in her yard, and I thought what an interesting looking woman this was, and I wondered about what her backstory was, what her past was, and so on. And that made me think one of these days I'd write a story about a woman in Botswana. And that bubbled away in my subconscious mind for some time, and then later on I sat down and wrote about a woman in Botswana, but it wasn't that particular woman. Mara Matswi, as with all the other characters in that book, based, I suppose, on the sort of people that I've met. You meet human types.
So a composite of sorts.
A composite. Mm. You meet all sorts of human types as you go through life, and they often are put together. A bit from such and such a person, a bit from another person. Or indeed, they're entirely fictional. Some fictional characters are entirely imaginary.
Mm. The fact that the number one ladies' detective agency series set around a detective agency has always fascinated me, because I would probably more classify her as a psychologist or a counsellor, would you?
Well, I think that's right. I don't really...
Not a lot of crime happens.
No, there's
serious
no crime.
Serious crime.
No, in fact, there's no crime in these books. There's occasionally there's something which might just be illegal, but only just illegal.
Yeah.
So we don't have... we have no murders. I mean, there's nothing like that. There are no bodies. And, of course, that is defying the genre. If you write detective fiction, then you actually tend to have that sort of thing. And indeed, even more so in contemporary crime fiction, you've got to have the post-mortem examination scene by page 10. Otherwise, the readers say, where is it?
Some sort of DNA check.
And a DNA. DNA
exactly.
Is very, very,
very
important for crime fiction. Of course, I think if one thinks about it, DNA actually ruins lots of things, because you can solve it absolutely correctly. So I think there are those requirements. I think crime fiction spends too much time looking at homicide. Homicide actually is a very rare crime. There are not many homicides. There are rather too many, I suppose. People would say we could do with fewer. But in fact, if you look at the overall picture of criminal conduct, there are far more mundane offences. And if crime writers really wanted to be social realists, they should write about something much more common, such as parking offences. You see, that's something which is very, very common. And where are the novels about parking offences?
Well, see, there's a whole area you haven't tapped into yet. And infidelity, I guess, is some of the things we look at in your, in some of the,
yes,
remotely.
Yes, Mara Maltby really is concerned with dealing with the problems in people's lives.
The moral problems
in people's lives, how we should treat other people, what do we owe to other people, that sort of thing. So she's a sort of agony aunt, come, as you say, psychologist, and a bit of a philosopher as well. She's a homespun philosopher. Well, one of my other series of books, Isabel Dalhousie, series set in Edinburgh, that actually also follows that up. Isabel Dalhousie solves problems in people's lives. She does it from a rather different perspective. She's a professional philosopher, and so she often gets it wrong, whereas Mara Maltby, who's not a professional philosopher, uses intuition and gets it right.
Mm. So, in fact, she's just someone, it seems, who listens. And I wondered then through this whether your stories are more fable-like than anything. Does that sit comfortably with you?
Yes, I'm perfectly happy with that. And indeed, I'd be perfectly happy to say I write it certainly in those books in the number one latest detective agency series. I am writing fables, but fables can have some grounding in reality, so you can set them in.
Well, it's essential, isn't it?
Yes, you can set them in the world as we know it, and so fables can have modern technology in them. But effectively, what you're doing in a fable is trying to extract some real truth, something more important from mundane human affairs in order to make a particular point. And I think Mara Maltby...
Like parking tickets.
Is it? Well, yes. I think we need to move on from that.
Alexander McColl-Smith is my guest here at the 891 ABC tent on ABC Afternoons. It's inescapable to see that you are a prolific writer. I've talked to many authors through this week and over my career, and often it's talked about in a very, as a tortured process, a long, exacting kind of thing that you would do. But for you, it seems, and you often say it comes quite easily.
Yes, well, I don't want to, certainly wouldn't want to boast about that, but I am very fortunate in that it does appear to come quite easily. I write quite quickly, I write 1,000 words an hour when I'm writing. Yes,
that's usually the daily limit for every author I've spoken to.
Well, of course, people like Flaubert. I think he wrote 35 words a week. very good words, and they were in French. I find that the words just come to me. I don't have to sit there and think what's going to happen, what's he going to say to her, what's she going to say to him, that sort of thing. It just comes naturally. And I think it's a question of being in touch with the subconscious mind, which is where I think a great deal of fiction is made up, at a subconscious level. So rather than it being the result of deliberation, cogitation, it comes from this part of the mind which is exploring the world all the time and asking what-if questions about the world.
So would you say you live in your subconscious mind then, because it's a streamlining to the stories?
Well,
you're kind of mainlining these stories.
Yes, I think probably. I know that we're all meant to be amateur neuroscientists these days. I don't really know very much, but in fact, I know nothing about it. That won't stop my expressing a view. but I think that the subconscious mind, when we're looking at the world, the subconscious mind, without our knowing it, is asking questions about it and exploring possibilities. So I think all that happens with a novelist is that the novelist actually develops those brain pathways which enable the conscious mind to access in some way what the subconscious mind is up to. It's rather like playing the piano. When you learn to play the piano, you don't actually do it or if you're going to be any good playing the piano, you don't sit there thinking, I'm going to put my thumb on the C and I'm going to put my middle finger on G and things like that. You automatically go to it. It's developed through practice, and that's why it's so difficult to learn the piano as an adult, because we don't have the wiring, or the wiring isn't functioning as quite as well as it is when we're children. So you develop that automatic access to the ability to put the key the fingers into the right position on the keyboard. And I think the same thing happens with writing. It's a matter of practice, in the same way as running or pole vaulting or anything else is. You actually practice it, and you develop a facility at reaching this subconscious mind, which is creating these stories.
So do you find that you ramp up your ability to produce writing as you get older?
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I really would use this analogy of being fit for physical exercise. I mean, we all know that if we don't go to the gym for a couple of weeks, we fall off. But if we go to the gym every day, we develop greater facility and ability. And I think it's the same with writing. You do develop those abilities. So I feel that I possibly write more easily and perhaps more fluently than 10, 20 years ago, because I've been doing quite a lot of it.
I guess when you're doing a series, you don't have to... You know who the characters are already, too. That helps, doesn't it?
That's one of the great things about being a serial novelist, having your series, is that you don't actually really have to reintroduce the characters to the readers. The readers, in most cases, are going to know who the character is, and that is makes it a little bit easier. Now, you do have to make it possible for the reader to come in later on in the series, and I think that's the hallmark of a good series, that it will admit the reader on volume 4 or 5 or whatever it is, and give a little bit of information about what's happened before, without ladling it on with the trowel, which would obviously annoy the people who've read the previous ones. So it's quite attractive proposition to a writer to have a serial novel. The other thing I think that's very important is that with a series of novels where you've got the same characters, you have the pleasure of spending time in the company of characters you know. I mean, we all like to have a cup of tea with an old friend. Because we feel we don't have to explain ourselves to them, we feel we know them, and there's a certain attraction in familiarity. Mm. We like people and places we know, and I think that also applies with fictional characters. We want to be in their company. I look forward every year to my annual sitting down with Mara Motsui and her friends in the number one Lady Detective Agency. I look forward to my annual Scotland Street volume, my annual Isabel Dalhousie volume. It's going back to old friends.
Yeah. So that actually probably leads me into where I wanted to go next, which was, given that you are a serial novelist, Isabel Dalhousie, 44 Scotland Street, number one Ladies Detective Agency, what determines which book, which lives, which characters you're going to do at what time?
That's a very complicated program that I have, which is discussed with various people in various countries, and there are a team of people who assist me in this, and we sit down, or they do most of the sitting down, working out what the program will be. I will say, well, I want to, I'm particularly keen to write such and such a thing this year, and they try and accommodate me. And they know.
But other than that, you just do what you're told? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think I do what I'm told. Once we agree the schedule, then I do what I'm told. Right. So they don't say to me, you will do such and such book this year. They wait until I say I'd like to do it, or they would put it as a suggestion. Of course, once we've agreed on a book, then it goes almost into production before I write it. They design the covers before I've written the book. We get the title before I've written the book, and sometimes they write the blurb before I've written the book, and that can lead to complications.
You reckon?
Because, you know, just before a publication, they say, but you know, in the blurb you said there's a horse in this story. Where's the horse? That sort of thing. So it's all planned well in advance.
Alexander McCall Smith is my guest. When you write, you're a man of great distinction. You are incredibly, in the stories, civilized. There are a lot of manners and that sort of thing involved. I understand that's very important to you, that we have sort of benevolence and...
Yes.
An optimism about the stories.
I think so. I think that if we look at the world is a veil of tears. It's a very harrowing and it's a place of great suffering by any standards. And we can look around ourselves and see all sorts of sad things happening. Now, I think that... the various reactions to that. I don't think we need to deny that, and we mustn't deny that. But I think that we need to remind ourselves that there's another side to life apart from this bleak vision of the world. That alongside suffering and deprivation, there are also many instances of lives that are being led in a very good way, and that for every instance of human vice. In the broad sense, you will find human virtues as well, and you'll find people leading virtuous lives, not in wearing their heart on their sleeves or anything of that sort, but actually just leading good lives. Somebody like Mara Matsui, who just gets on with life in a good way. And I happen to be a writer who writes at that end of the spectrum. I write books that perhaps have a humorous dimension to them, or perhaps look at love. I write quite a lot about love, and generally speaking, love in my books comes to fruition. There are difficulties in the way, and I think that unfulfilled love or undeclared love, unreciprocated love, are very great themes, and I deal with those. But I want to write about human benevolence as well.
Would you describe yourself as an optimist?
I probably would. I'm not an optimist in the sense of somebody who thinks that good is going to triumph, because there's the sort of optimist who'd say, oh, everything's going to be all right.
Yes.
And you could be on the Titanic, and the optimist will say, don't worry, you know, we're going to miss the iceberg, or we're not sinking.
Yeah.
Now, those sort of optimists often don't have a long life expectancy. and they're often quite wrong. So the other sort of optimist is one who says, well, I hope that things are going to be all right, or things aren't too bad, which is another aspect.
A realistic optimist.
I think if you try to work out a philosophical position for yourself in this life, you can come up with the conclusion that life is utterly miserable and bleak, and let's all be utterly miserable and bleak ourselves. Now, in my view, that actually doesn't achieve anything. I don't think that gets you anywhere. So I think you actually have to make a decision to make the best of life, and to try to lead life in the most positive way that you can. And I suspect that most people would sign up to that. I suspect that that's what most people do.
Mm.
So the vision of life as being bleak and horrible, and the idea that literature should just deal with that, seems to me to be odd.
Now, a lot of the people here will be, I'm sure, going off to see you talk as well with Ali Clark, who will be hosting the session on the stage at 3:45. But I want to give a couple of our texters an opportunity, who are listening to you at home around South Australia, to ask a couple of questions. First of all, will Elizabeth Dalhousie and Mara Mawatsi ever meet, and the little boy from Scotland too? Asks one of our callers, Robin.
Well, Robin, thank you for that question. I am asked that from time to time, and I always say no, they won't meet. And the reason for that is that I think that fiction involves a bit of a suspension of disbelief anyway. When you create a fictional universe, you're asking the reader to believe in this fictional universe. So you're asking for the suspension of certain natural cynicism or caution. So if you then mix up your characters, you're creating a fictional universe that is twice as unlikely as the original. So I'd love Mara Motswe and Isabel Dalhousie to meet. I'd love them to sit down to a cup of Red Bush tea. Mara Motswe would drink the Red Bush tea. Isabel Dalhousie would drink her white New Zealand wine. I'd love that to happen, but it's not going to happen.
And another texter says, when, Alexander McCall-Smith, are you going to bring your orchestra to the Adelaide Festival?
Well, how kind of you to suggest that invitation. And I hope that the festival authorities are listening to this. And they will. Our orchestra is called the Rarely Terrible Orchestra, which is what it is. It's been playing or trying to play for 20 years. My wife and I founded it about 20 years ago. It's become the most successful and most appreciated and most laughed at amateur orchestra in the world. And we are really bad. We are really terrible. I'll give you an example. There was one occasion when our conductor just stopped us and he said, "Nope, stop, let's take a look at this." And in fact, what happened was that one of the sections was playing an entirely different piece of music. We're seriously bad. But we'll come at the drop of a hat. We will come to Adelaide and we'll get very big audiences because people love seeing a group of rank amateurs making fools of themselves on the stage. They love it.
Well, I suspect you would get a large audience wherever you were, no matter what you were doing, Alexander McCall-Smith. But thank you so much for sharing some of your stories and your thoughts with us today. And, of course, on a wider scale, for sharing your stories over many decades. I'm sure many people have appreciated it very much.
Thank you very much indeed.